From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Maryland scientists are joining others from around the world looking for a cure for Alzheimer's disease and just as pressing for better ways to treat dementia and help caregivers cope. Dr. Paul Rosenberg, Associate Director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center, joins us from the conference in Washington. Then Tom Hall introduces us to the new Executive Director of the Shriver Hall Concert Series. Catherine Cochran takes the helm at Shriver Hall as it enters its 50th anniversary season of classical concerts. Plus, we talk to our regular fashion contributor Zoe Washington about fashion magazines making the transition to lifestyle publications and to running their own online shopping sites. And the environment in focus with Tom Pelton. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. 4,000 scientists are meeting at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Washington to share the latest research about dementia, prospects for a cure or treatment, best ways of managing the disease, or if possible, delaying it. 5 million Americans already suffer from Alzheimer's, a number predicted to double as baby boomers age in the next couple of decades. Much of the research discussed this week is aimed at identifying people most likely to develop Alzheimer's years before symptoms appear, aiming to stall the disease if not completely prevent it. Several specialists from Johns Hopkins are working to develop such screens. Dr. Paul Rosenberg is Associate Director of the Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He specializes in symptoms people show before dementia shows up and in measurements to understand the diagnostic criteria of the disease. And Dr. Rosenberg joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
With 4,000 researchers trading insights, there are a lot of headlines coming out of this international conference. From your perspective, what is the big news? What should people know about this meeting?
There's a lot of news, and here are some of the themes. The first is, in general, we're working backwards. 15 years ago, we were mostly working with people who we knew had Alzheimer's disease and already had significant symptoms. And we've been working backwards toward people who are at risk of the disease, and we're even now working toward people who have no symptoms at all, where we're basically looking for biologic measurements and other clinical measurements that they're at risk of the disease. And we're working backwards for a couple reasons. One is we think our best chance of making a difference is as early as possible. And what is remarkable is the first time you go to the doctor with worrying about the disease, you may have had it for many, many years. So we feel like you got to catch it early. And we're starting to make some progress. For years, we've known that memory problems are often the first symptom. And one of the things I'm working on with my group is the idea that psychiatric symptoms are also early symptoms. Alzheimer's is not just a disease of memory. It also involves changes in mood. People can become depressed. They can lose interest in things. We call it apathy. They certainly can become anxious. And later in the disease, particularly, they often become agitated, irrationally angry. They're all symptoms of the disease, and they're not just psychologic reactions to knowing you have it.
That's what I was wondering, whether some people get, for example, depressed because they feel that their brain is not working right.
Quite a few people are dealing with the diagnosis and are upset, depressed, demoralized because of that. But what's really interesting is there's little relation between these diseases and your insight and awareness of, these symptoms and your insight and awareness of the disease. A lot of people are getting the symptoms kind of out of the blue without realizing they're struggling with the disease.
And do these symptoms, these psychiatric symptoms that you're describing, the anxiousness, the apathy, the depression, do they, you said a minute ago that by the time we see what we consider symptoms of Alzheimer's, people may have had the disease for quite some time. So these symptoms may show up early?
They may show up early. What's been happening in the field, for years we've known that memory problems maybe the first symptom of the disease. And now we're finding that psychiatric symptoms can be. We're doing a symposium tomorrow on this. We've coined the term mild behavioral impairment. It goes along with mild cognitive impairment, which are the memory problems. And in mild behavioral impairment, these are generally older people who have for the first time some of these symptoms. And what we found is that the onset of these symptoms can be quite predictive of the disease. I was working with a large data set funded by your tax dollars, the National Alzheimer's Coordinating Center, which combines data from 34 or so Alzheimer's centers. And I found that if people reported even one symptom, this is quite mild. This is not much different than you having a bad day at the office. If people reported even one symptom overall, or if they reported one depressive symptom, this increased their risk of advancing to Alzheimer's by about 40%. It was a lot. And this kind of risk has been replicated in a few data sets. So we're presenting tomorrow on this. Not only, we find the risk not only in people who already have cognitive symptoms, we call it mild cognitive impairment, but even in people who have no symptoms at all, who are quite normal. And we've even found, although we don't have many autopsies, in a small group of folks with autopsies, we find they have more Alzheimer's pathology, even though they're at a very early stage.
So what to do about these psychiatric symptoms?
Well, I'm actually more attracted to lifestyle than standard psychiatric treatments. So we don't yet have evidence that, for instance, antidepressants affect the course. They might, but they really might not. I'm suspecting that reduction of stress, things like relaxation techniques, meditation, yoga, tai chi, exercise, kind of standard ways to reduce stress, maybe one of the most helpful interventions. We don't know yet, because we're just starting to define these folks. We also want people to be able to use these as a marker that there might be something going on. It's also a broader issue in the field. We have some new brain scans. We call it amyloid scans. And amyloid is a chemical that is deposited in the brain in the form of plaques in Alzheimer's disease. And a substantial number of older persons with no symptoms have plaques in their brain. Anywhere from 25 to, if you're in your 80s, it's up to 40%. And we think these folks are at risk of getting Alzheimer's, and we think, in fact, that's the magic moment where we could do prevention. But we're not absolutely sure. If it does prove to be the case, one of the challenges of amyloid imaging is it's expensive. It's easily $5,000, and insurance is not currently covering it. It's quite a controversial issue. I personally think we're going to start finding low-tech, inexpensive methods that will help us predict who's got amyloid in their brain, and so we can restrict these scans to a much smaller group of people.
That's Dr. Paul Rosenberg, Associate Director of the Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine here on Maryland Morning and WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about some of the research discussed at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Washington this week. I want to pick up on that. Your colleague, Marilyn Albert, who directs the Division of Cognitive Neuroscience at Johns Hopkins, got a lot of attention with her presentation Sunday about an effective way to screen, a sort of low-tech way in some ways, to screen for who is likely to develop Alzheimer's.
It's a very interesting study. She's been on the latter stages of a very long-term study. These were folks who were middle-aged and who had a family member who had Alzheimer's disease. So they were a risk group, but a risk group because of family history. And they got lumbar punctures, spinal taps, and they got sensitive cognitive tests, and they've been followed for a long time. I'm not part of the study, and I don't have the details. I think it's at least 15 years. And what she found was that some standard measures in the spinal fluid, measures that we are that we're all familiar with. It looks at amyloid and another chemical called tau. If you looked at that ratio and a couple of standard psychological tests, cognitive tests, you had a pretty good chance of predicting who got Alzheimer's. This is very interesting because these are measures that are available to us. A spinal tap is, it's invasive. It's you have to put a needle in your back.
It sounds pretty serious to me.
You know, actually, what's very interesting about spinal taps is they have less complications and less side effects in older people than young people.
Hmm.
It's because older people have less spinal fluid, and when you take it out, it doesn't cause as much shrinkage. It's a complicated thing. But the thing is, she's been able to do very good prediction with pretty standard tests. And my thought is we may be able to combine these kinds of things, which are much less expensive than amyloid imaging, and are fairly available already. Certainly, they're doable. And we've got a couple of other things. We also may be combining it with subjective memory complaints. Studies from Rebecca Amarillo and other folks at Harvard suggest that actually, if you have a family member who's worried about your memory, that's a pretty good predictor. Another predictor may be new onset psychiatric symptoms. And another predictor may be genetics. We don't have a gene for Alzheimer's that's going to help us predict it in most people. There are rare genes for Alzheimer's that predict it. But really, there's a group of genes, each of which has a small effect. But with advances in genetics, in 5-10 years, this may be a rather inexpensive risk profile.
But we have just a couple minutes left, and I want to ask the basic question of why. If we don't have a treatment for Alzheimer's, what is the value of knowing 5 years in advance I'm likely to develop this terrible disease?
I deeply appreciate your segue, because they're talking quite a bit about new treatments. So just a couple of hours ago, they released some embargoed data. It's Lilly Pharmaceuticals. The drug is called solanezumab. It's an antibody against amyloid. They've had some relatively promising results in early Alzheimer's disease, and they've been moving this along. And the results are somewhat complicated to explain scientifically, but as they followed people further, the effect continued. And they have a suspicion that they have what we call a disease-modifying effect, actually affecting the disease. The controversy with these drugs is not so much whether they work. They work at least to some extent, but whether the effect will be large enough to make a difference in people's lives.
And we have to leave it at that point because we're almost out of time. I really appreciate your giving us this insight into the conference. Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about my favorite field.
Dr. Paul Rosenberg is Associate Director of the Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's taking part in the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Washington this week. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And the Diane Reams Show will have more about the Alzheimer's Conference in 45 minutes. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on our show, Bluegrass. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're actually going to talk about bluegrass a little later this month. This morning, we're going to talk about Shriver Hall. The Shriver Hall Concert Series is celebrating its 50th anniversary this season in recitals on the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University. The Shriver Hall Series has presented some of the world's most famous musicians in an intimate setting, playing and singing some of the great masterpieces of chamber music and introducing new works to the canon. Shriver Hall will celebrate their golden anniversary with a new executive director, Catherine Catherine Cochran comes to the venerable arts organization after more than a dozen years at the 92nd Street Y in New York. And Catherine Cochran joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show and welcome to Maryland.
Thank you so much. And thank you for this warm welcome. I'm so delighted to be here.
Yeah, and you're hot off the presses. Your first day of work was Monday.
Yes, indeed.
Well, you're very nice to play hooky from work for a little while and come by and chat with us. What were the attractions of this job? You're up there in New York working for the 92nd Street Y, a very, you know, internationally known series of concerts and lectures and stuff. Why did you decide to take an interest in Baltimore?
Well, Shriver Hall Concert Series has a national reputation for excellence, as you said, presenting some of the finest and most compelling artists of the day. And so I've been long aware of the series and its activities. And it's also a place in the artistic community that where it's well known that artists love to perform and come back year after year. And that's there's no finer compliment for a series or an organization than that. So that was definitely a draw. And then also Baltimore as a city is dynamic with a rich cultural life and warm personality. And so living here was also definitely an appeal.
Yeah, great. I mean, so I knew that happened to me when I came to Baltimore way back in 1982. I was living in Boston at the time, and I talked to people about this group that I was interested in, and they seemed to be interested in me, the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. And people said, oh, yeah, they're fun to work with. It's really, I've been to Baltimore, I've sung with them, I've played with them, they're fun. Is that what you heard from people, you know, who are appearing with you in New York and just sort of people in the business, performers in the business? Shriver has a good reputation?
Absolutely. It's a place where, as I said, artists love coming back time and again, and that's for the audience, a knowledgeable and appreciative audience. And for the team, the experience of being in the city and rehearsing and being at the hotel and all of that being well taken care of for sure is part of the reputation. And as I did my research and talked to people, it was definitely something I heard both from artist managers and other colleagues as well as the artists themselves.
Yeah, it's good to hear. Now, of course, Baltimore took a hit nationally in terms of its reputation with the riots and uprising that occurred in late April. From your vantage point in New York, you're thinking, oh, I'm about to move down there. I mean, what were your impressions when you saw that coverage, you read about what was going on here?
Well, I'd say that, I mean, it's clear that the arts were had an interesting role of that. I'll never forget the day following on social media with Baltimore Symphony doing a free outdoor concert in the midst of all of that and finding that in a remarkable moment. So clearly, you know, the arts were not cowering in a corner by any means, but really much, you know, being community leaders and serving their role as a vibrant and inspiring part to the community here. And so that I found very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I'd also say that, you know, that moments like that are a blip in time and hardly define a city. And there's certainly, it's an interesting moment for sure. And a moment when the arts in Baltimore are incredibly important. But it's, you know, Baltimore so much more than that particular moment.
Yeah. Catherine Cochran is here. She's the new executive director of the Shriver Hall Concert Series. She started work on Monday on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So tell us about your work at the 92nd Street Y in New York. What were you doing up there?
Sure. 92nd Street Y is a cultural community center offering programs in a whole wide variety of areas. It has a 70-concert season. There's an extensive literature program of readings and classes, talks, nursery school, after school, education, fitness, etc. So I worked in the concert program for 14 years. It's primarily chamber music, recitals, as well as jazz and American songbooks. So working the programming and operations of that with artists such as the Tokyo String Quartet, which was in residence for 10 years. Has a niche in classical guitar programming with artists such as David Russell, Benjamin Verdery, LAGQ, the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, among many others. Working closely with the School of the Music there, as well as the educational outreach programs. And then more recently, I have been charged with new initiatives. So looking at other areas of concert programming that could be opportunities. So world music, some Americana, and beginning to carve that out in the programming and offerings of the 92nd Street Y.
So do you think it's going to be much different? I mean, obviously, 92nd Street Y, you mentioned 70 concerts a year. That's many more than you'll be producing at Shriver. I mean, Shriver, the series is what, 6 or 7?
It's 11 in total. Right, so 8 in the main subscription series in Shriver Hall, and then 3 Discovery concerts in different places around Baltimore and Baltimore County.
I mean, the fact that the scale is different, you know, it's going to be a little smaller and it's a smaller market. Does that matter one way or the other to you? Do you think it's going to be different than booking things in Manhattan?
It's certainly going to be different. I think, though, Shriver has a very vital role in serving the community, and I think being able to really focus deeply on that is something I find very exciting and I'm looking forward to. And I would say that, you know, in some ways it's not different. The artists who are coming to Shriver Hall, and that Shriver Hall is attracting season after season, are exactly the same in terms of caliber and international reputation and that. So in some ways, yes, it's familiar as well as being, it'll be a change.
Yeah. Does it matter that the market here in terms of the audience is smaller? I mean, there's just a smaller pool of people available to come to concerts. When we talk about, you know, attracting people to classical music now. In New York, I remember years ago, I had a friend who was conducting Messiah at Lincoln Center. And it was in December. It was Handel's Messiah, which is a, you know, Christmas thing that they do every year. Them and a whole lot of other people. He was coming from Boston. He had a group in Boston. His name is Marty Perlman. It was a group called Boston Baroque. And he looked in the New York Times, and there were 12 performances of Messiah happening in Manhattan Friday, Saturday, and Sunday that weekend. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. And he said, how does anybody, you know, attract an audience? But in fact, they sold out, you know, Avery Fisher, because there's just so many people. I mean, there's 10 million people in New York. If, you know, 0.1% go, then you've got a big crowd. Does the size of the market matter to you or strike you as something that's going to be important in terms of your outreach to audiences?
I guess I don't think so much about size. I think about who's coming. You know, Shriver is very lucky to have a strong subscriber base, a loyal, supportive subscriber base as our core to build off of. And then what I'm really interested in is looking at the different aspects of Baltimore, different communities in Baltimore and beyond, and how we can welcome them in and provide a personal invitation to them that this is music for them and that we are here to be a resource for them.
Yeah. Have you, you worked, as I understand it, with NPR Music in New York, and you did some initiatives with, I guess, the New York Philharmonic and the Met. You were collaborating with other organizations. What were the nature of those collaborations, and how will that experience inform what you might do here in Baltimore?
Sure. Yes. Collaborating was a big part of what we did in New York. And each one was its own creation. So with performance organizations like the New York Philharmonic or the New York Guitar Festival and such, it was co-programming, bringing our resources together to create a festival or ongoing chamber music series, in the case with the New York Philharmonic, with Performance Today and QXR and with NPR Music, it was around broadcasting, obviously. We kept providing our recorded concerts to them for broadcast, but also with NPR Music, that was a very special occasion when we did a memorial concert for jazz pianist Marion McPartland, who well known for her piano jazz series. And we were part of NPR Music's Jazz Night in America, which was incredibly exciting to have a national webcast. So in terms of looking at Shriver Hall and how this will inform, absolutely. I think that, as I said, Baltimore has a rich cultural life with a number of wonderful music organizations and community organizations, and finding those connections and places to build off of and create new projects, sort of bigger and better than either of us could do on our own, is something is definitely a priority in terms of, you know, amplifying our message and finding new audiences and new entry points for audiences. Mm-hmm.
What do you think the message is for Shriver Hall? It's interesting that, you know, all the organizations here in town, the Symphony, my organization, the Choral Arts Society, the Baltimore Chamber Orchestra, we're all interested in connecting connecting with the community. We use this rhetoric that talks about connecting and relevance. You know, the museums talk about this, the theater companies talk about this. What do you think the connection point is for a group like Shriver Hall, a series like Shriver Hall, and the broader community?
Well, I would say I would say music is not a luxury for a community. Arts is not a luxury for a community. It helps us understand ourselves and the world around us. It broadens our experience and sparks our imagination and really enriches our daily lives. And it's both a private experience, but also a collective experience. And I would say with Shriver Hall, it's experiencing thrilling live encounters in an, as you said, an intimate space that you can't experience on your own in a recording. And we focus on recitals and chamber music, and I think we're, if I dare say, the best place to hear that and have that experience here in Baltimore.
You're definitely allowed to dare to say that. You know, there are other people who may say the same thing, but they can be dared to say it too. That's your gig now, you know.
Indeed.
The people in the classical music business have been predicting the demise of classical music for years. I mean, Ernest Fleischmann, who was the executive director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, wrote an op-ed, I think, 50 years ago, saying, "You know, classical music is dead. We should all jump ship now." It hasn't happened yet.
Nope.
What's your take on the current status of classical music with the body politic?
I'd say yes. The people have been asking that question for decades, and we are all still here. I think how people listen to and experience music and consume it has certainly evolved. It's always been evolving. And I think we're at an incredibly interesting moment as we have a number of artists and performers and composers who, through the wonderful advent of technology and from the last 15 years and such, have consumed a broader range of music than ever before was, you know, really possible without enormous effort. And so I think that that diversity of point of view and that vibrancy is absolutely there. And I think in terms of how classical music exists, not in a vacuum, but is interacting with other forms of music and other forms of artists and other genres. And so I'm excited.
A guy named Jesse Rosen, who heads a thing called the League of American Symphony Orchestras. It's the professional organization for symphonies in the United States. Many years ago, coined a term called CANA, C-A-N-A, culturally aware non-attenders.
Mm-hmm.
People who knew about the symphony, knew about the opera and the ballet and their cities, but they just didn't go for various reasons. You know, the chances are that there are a number of culturally aware non-attenders even just listening to us this morning. State the case to them for why they should give Shriver Hall a try.
Shriver Hall is, it's thrilling. It's about the joys of live performance and that dynamism and electricity and an intimate encounter between artist and audience that you cannot experience in any other genre. And experiencing that with people sitting next to you and the element of the unknown of what's going to happen in any given concert. I think that's the biggest why you should get off the couch and come to a live performance.
Yeah, and with the internet and the you know, huge ubiquity of music that you can find on YouTube and on iTunes for almost nothing or particularly nothing. It really is a different experience when you're in a hall with other people listening to music being performed.
Absolutely. They complement each other.
But the internet can both be then a good thing and a rotten thing for us trying to get people interested in art music.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the internet helping and hurting Shriver Hall?
I think it's a tool of exploration and discovery that the barrier of experimenting with something new or saying, "Oh, I've heard about this person. What is that all about?" It's you just go to YouTube and in that, you know, in that moment and for no cost, you can discover that. And then I think the much richer, deeper dive is the live performance, the unknown and the high quality that, you know, not everything online is of the highest audio quality.
Sure. Well, Catherine Cochran, welcome to town.
Thank you.
Break a leg.
Thank you very much.
All right, Catherine Cochran, she's the new executive director of the Shriver Hall Concert Series in Baltimore. Concerts take place in Shriver Hall on the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University. Their 50th anniversary season kicks off September 20th with a recital by a Shriver Hall favorite, the pianist Yefim Bronfen. We'll have a complete list of all of the concerts they're offering this summer, or this season rather, on our website, wypr.org/ Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Marilyn Morning. Fashionista Zoe Washington stops by in a little while to talk to Sheila about the changing landscape of fashion magazines. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. There's always a new trend afoot in the world of fashion, and one of the changes that seems to be going on now is that some of the beautiful glossy magazines that used to tell us about fashion trends are now delivering those fashion pieces as retailers. I learned this from Marilyn Morning's regular guest and fashion advisor, Zoe Washington, who's just back from a grand European tour. Welcome back, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
We're used to fashion magazines lining the checkout aisles at grocery stores. Is the popularity of these magazines growing or dwindling?
I would say in large part they're dwindling, unfortunately, being somebody whose entire job is tied to publications. It's unfortunate to say, but yes, their popularity is dwindling. I don't think that we're going to see, you know, clear checkout aisles anytime soon, but they aren't as relevant as they used to be.
Why not?
I think that's because, one, the digital age. People are getting their content online, and that's just sort of the fact of the matter. And I think that when that first started, especially in the early 2000s, when that really started to take hold, a lot of publications didn't know what to offer online. You know, they didn't know, should we be having people pay for this service and information? Should this content be free? And then it became sort of a monster that constantly needed feeding. So when you go online and you look at, say, Harper's Bazaar.com or Vogue.com. There's content that's specifically made for the website. There's content from the magazine. What content they choose to include, whether or not they want you to pay for it, it's very confusing. And I think it's hard for them because you have to constantly feed the beast. People want more and more content, and they want it for free. And they're used to now not paying for it. So a lot of publications are having to create new editorial staffs just to keep up with this demand, but they're not necessarily seeing the return on the revenue. Of course, there's ad revenue that they can get from it, but it's nowhere near what they were able to charge for print publications.
And all that parallels what we've seen in the news business, in news magazines and newspapers, more of which now are setting up a paywall and saying, you can read a few articles for free, but if you really want to get deep into our reporting, you have to help pay for it.
Exactly. And I think it's difficult for more lifestyle or fashion-based publications because, you know, if you don't know what's happening in the world via the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or what have you, that's not a good thing. You need to know what's going on in the world. If you don't know about culottes, you're still okay. You know, you don't need to pay to find out about the 6 best culottes to buy for spring, summer. That's something you can do without. So I think that they're realizing they need to offer content. If they're going to create a paywall, they need content that is worthy of that.
And so are we talking more about more lifestyle and less just straight fashion?
I think so. I think what you see publications doing now is that they're trying to build themselves into brands. It's always been the case in a lot of ways, publications kind of steered the ship for a lot of big lifestyle brands that you see now, or even the sort of 360 approach that a lot of department stores took. So in that way, they were pioneers, but now they have a lot of catching up to do. So you'll see stuff like Allure. You know, Allure might get into creating their own beauty line, or Essence Magazine might get into creating their own hair extension line, because beauty and hair is something that is very important to their reader. Building out an entire brand that lives beyond the publication is very important right now. So whether that's going into e-commerce, or in the case of Essence, for example, creating the Essence Music Festival and doing subsequent festivals around the world, so that you create an experience that's tied into the readership.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Zoe Washington, a fashion editor and CEO of the company Little Bird, a fashion consulting service. It could be that people who read fashion magazines aren't expecting a sort of good housekeeping consumer guide approach, but doesn't this
sort of undercut the credibility of a magazine if it's in business for itself, if it's selling its own makeup line?
Completely. And that's why it's been a very difficult transition for them. I think you see magazines like Teen Vogue, for example, has a very popular line of bedding. Now, that makes sense because Teen Vogue is about more than just at-home services and at-home goods. So having a line of bedding dedicated to the teen market makes sense and doesn't necessarily get in their way. But for a lot of magazines like Harper's Bazaar, Allure, Vogue, Elle, the idea of broaching into e-commerce has been very tricky. Shop Bazaar launched a couple of years ago, and what they do is the traditional sort of like click and buy model where it takes you to the site of the actual designer that creates this garment, and they might get a percentage of that sale, sort of like reward style kind of thing. But other magazines like Lucky, the now defunct Lucky, went full steam ahead in trying to, and it made sense. It made sense to a lot of people. Okay, here's Lucky Magazine. It's a magazine about shopping. The pages were very shoppable. That was the whole point of the magazine. So having a shoppable website made sense. And so when they went down that road, the problem was, is, okay, are we handling the back end? Who's handling the back end of the shopping experience? Having an e-commerce site is a very labor-intensive project. So an already, you know, a group of people who are already stretched a little bit too thin providing content for online and the publication are now having to, what, edit this website that's going to be offering clothes that people can buy. It's very difficult. And they get in their way. I mean, you do wonder, okay, is this really the best hair comb? Is this the best button-down shirt? Is this the best jean? Or is it that you guys make it?
So you said Lucky is defunct.
Lucky is defunct now. And Lucky transitioned to Lucky Shops, which was a website that was basically the content. They were almost kind of trying to go backwards, like the Net-a-Porter model, where there was an e-commerce site that then also grew out into be a publication. So Lucky was doing the reverse of that, a publication that was trying to become an e-commerce site. And it was very difficult. I think that they did have some success, but I don't think that the audience was quite there for it.
How does social media factor into this?
I think that with social media right now, they're trying to figure out how to make, for example, Instagram shoppable. I think all of that has made it a little bit difficult for a lot of publications, in that this is more content that they need to be feeding out, that they need to be blowing out from their core stories, that they're paying very good salaries for people to create. So for social networking and all the social media sites, it's a great way to stay in contact with their readers and to know what their readers are listening to and what they are responding to. But at the same time, it's a double-edged sword. It's okay, well, we have this social media, what do we do with this captive audience? How do we try to sell things without seeming like ads for ourselves?
And do you see social media affecting fashion choices?
Oh, yes, there's no question. Stars are born and made on Instagram, you know, so there are people who are just shoveling product out there. And that really gets into the blogging and social media stars that are propelling the fashion world and are disruptors to the traditional fashion publication model. So here, you know, there's a blogger who will, you know, take pictures of herself walking around the streets of Paris. And how much more effective is that? Some one person showing you what she likes, then a whole staff of people who may or may not be getting kickbacks from advertisers, you know, because and putting this on the page. You know, this one person likes it and maybe she's getting it for free. So that whole thing is they're trying to catch up now with traditional print media and their ethos. It's a difficult situation. And I'm not quite sure who's going to come out on top, to be honest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Zoe Washington, fashion editor and CEO of the company Little Bird, a fashion consulting service for teens and tweens. You can read more about her work on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Marilyn Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1805, the trustees of the young Roman Catholic Diocese of Baltimore approved the design of Benjamin Henry Latrobe for a cathedral to be built between West Franklin and Mulberry Streets. It took 16 years, including several financial setbacks, to construct the building we now call the Basilica. It was dedicated in 1821. I'm Sheila Cass. We're back on Friday. Please join us.